No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us at BBSRADIOONE. That's 888-627-6008, and we'd love to make you part of the conversation. Maria, are you there?
Yes, Michael. Yep, I'm here, Michael.
We're going to have an interesting guest in the second half of the show.
Yeah, let's just promote that before we will address what events are going on down. But Dr. John Horton is our guest. He's an internal medicine specialist. He's going to be speaking with us about Zika and the latest news, which there were two events this week that broke that were new and novel. And he also wrote a book called The Inner Game of Stress. And his co-author is Timothy Galway, who wrote The Other Inner Games of, starting with tennis, which that one alone has sold over 2 million copies. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what Dr. Horton has to tell us about Zika and the new news.
Absolutely. It's a scary, scary proposition. I mean, I read a thing. We'll get onto that later. But I also read where the sailors in the Olympics want out now because the water's so polluted down there. It's just an amazing situation.
It is. So, first, of course, yes, we need to probably speak about Baton Rouge, the latest atrocity. Three police officers dead, one apparently fighting for their life, two other wounded, and the 29-year-old assailant dead on his birthday.
What is this? Why are we, you know, I just don't get it, that we have to fight terrorists and then we have to fight this as well. I mean, there's more of this going on in America than anything. I just don't get it. I don't know why people are resorting to this sort of violence. It just bewilders me.
I think you and I are both old school in that we subscribe to the newspapers and read them and turn the pages daily. This morning when I finished just the first section, my eyes welled up with tears and I thought, page after page, article after article, you know, atrocity and destruction and death and terrorism and, you know, Turkey. And I mean, it just goes, and Nice, and it just goes on and on and on. And I don't recall a time like this ever.
Well, you know, I mean, and the domestic stuff I find so perplexing because, you know what, I grew up in a generation where we were dissatisfied. We were dissatisfied. There was a war going on that we didn't like, and there were other things, a lot of social change going on. But we didn't go out and shoot cops. We showed up and we put flowers in the ends of the soldiers' guns. We didn't resort to this kind of violence. You know, Dr. King marched across the bridge from Selma to Montgomery. Nobody got up in a tower and lured police to a place where they could murder them. I just don't get what changed so drastically in America that we now see violence as an answer.
My guess is it has to be boiled down to mental health or the lack thereof. because a sane person doesn't do what this man did today.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not normal by any stretch. And, you know, they always say, well, normal, there's a range. And I get that, that we're all dysfunctional on some level. But what is concerning me, Michael, and we need to probably talk about that too, is that the right to carry, open carry, that is known in Ohio. I don't know if you've seen the pictures of people that they've been taking at Freedom Square, which is outside of where the convention is going to take place, at the Quicken Loans Arena. They've got guns wrapped around across their shoulders. And it's legal. And the Cleveland Police Union asked the Governor Kasich to suspend the open carry for the duration. And unfortunately, he said governors don't have the power to arbitrarily suspend federal and state constitutional rights or state law. There's nothing that can be done.
Well, you know, and I mean, if you look at, now I haven't looked at the Republican convention, what the prohibited things are at the Republican convention, but I've looked at the list at the Democratic convention, and there's things like aerosol cans. You can't bring a can of hairspray into the Democratic convention. I'm sure it's the same at the Republican convention.
Yeah, they said you can't bring metal-tipped umbrellas.
Right, metal-tipped umbrellas, but you can bring a semi-automatic handgun.
You cannot bring it in, but you can mill about with it. And they say there's going to be 3,000 law enforcement officers there, just like there will be with the Democratic convention. But they're expecting over 50,000 spectators to assemble. So the odds are... And then, of course, the parties that have been responsible for some of this are going to be there, and they're bringing heat.
Right. And, of course, if you want to start a damn riot, what a better place to start it than in a crowd full of people that are carrying guns on both sides.
I know.
You know, both the cops and the civilians. I mean, it's just crazy. And we've got to address all these things. We don't. Definitely have to address the mental health problem. We've got to certainly address the gun problem. They're just too easily accessible, and too many people have them. And you know, and the sad thing is, although I believe that the Second Amendment does give you the right to bear arms, there's no evidence that we have that we're any safer by giving people carry permits. There's no evidence at all. And almost every police department, as you said, the Cleveland police weighed in here, almost every police department is against open carry permits.
Well, you know, it's probably more to what we've spoken to prior on broadcasts, is what types of guns should be allowed into the hands of normal citizens. Assault rifles? Right. No. I mean, let's get real here. That wasn't what our forefathers had in mind, even though back then when they created this, it was a normal part of people's existence, if you will, just even to eat. But so now we've got, but somebody made the point this week too, is that what happened in Nice with the Bastille celebration didn't involve a gun. It was a truck who mowed down 80-some people.
I don't even know how that's possible. I got to tell you that.
They said he jumped the curb.
My mind.
Because they had the cordoned off, and he jumped the curb, and he just kept on going, plowing through people. And then apparently he was radicalized and quickly, because he was on nobody's radar in any shape or form.
And, of course, that's true of 9/11, too. I mean, you know, and who would have ever thought of that they would use commercial airliners as a weapon? You know, we know what happened with those brave, brave people in Shanksville, which brought that plane down. Mm-hmm. And I think that would have happened with all the planes if the people on board had any idea what was happening. I'm sure they had no idea. I'm sure that they thought they were being hijacked somewhere, that they were going to end up, you know, in
hostage somewhere.
Right. In Cuba or someplace else. But I'm sure they didn't for a moment think that they were going to crash those planes into buildings. In fact, I remember being home that morning, leaving late for a meeting. I had a late meeting that morning, and thinking to myself that as they were speculating that it was terrorism, saying to myself, no, some poor guy got lost going down the Hudson River, and there was a, you know, some, we're going to find out that some terrible thing has happened, like the pilot had a heart attack or, you know, something. And as I'm thinking this, I watched the second plane fly into the second building, you know, and at that
point, because we tried to make sense out of it.
Right.
You know, logical people in general, which is why I'm curious that since they found the black box of the Egyptian airline, we haven't heard a thing about what they're pulling off of that.
We haven't heard a thing.
Not a whisper. Not even. I love it when people speak on anonymity because they're not authorized to talk.
Yeah.
How did they find those sources?
I don't know. I think they make them up sometimes. Yeah.
Of anonymity. So let's go into a little bit about the convention, which starts tomorrow. And interesting, it's got a 1 o'clock p.m. start time on Monday, a 5:30 on Tuesday, a 7 p.m. on Wednesday, and a 7:30 p.m. on Thursday. And I'm assuming those are local times. But since you have attended conventions in the past, can you, because obviously they're going to approve the party platform, they're going to nominate Governor Mike Pence, they're going to nominate Trump, and then they attend workshops and conferences, and those speakers, of which there were 62 that were released. I'll go through a couple. But you've been there. What is it like?
Well, you know, they try to start. The idea, I think, is there's a couple of objectives. One is it's a big pep rally, right? They're always decided. It's been a long time since there's been a floor fight. In 1980, there was a brief one at the Democratic Convention when Ted Kennedy tried to take the nomination away from Jimmy Carter, and it lasted, about 10 minutes, and that was it. And that's the last time I remember there being a floor fight at the Democratic Convention. And I think it goes even further back for the Republican Convention, since there was a floor fight.
Contested.
First it's a pep rally, then they try to build it to a crescendo. You know, so the first day is what you said. It's all the mundane things. Pass the platform, all the speakers that nobody's particularly interested in. Then the second day, it's building up the troops at the Democratic convention. The second day will be Bill Clinton. The third day will be Obama and Joe Biden, because that's when the names are put into nomination, and that's the big night when everybody hugs and sings Kumbaya and they nominate the candidate. And then on the last night, of course, is the acceptance speech, and that's the big, you know, if you're looking for the big parties to go to and things like that, it's always on the last night. The last night is a big, big night of the convention. So that's kind of how it goes. So they want to come out. Well, everybody wants a bounce. You know, everybody wants to come out of that with the best media that they can get. And they want everybody to look like they're holding hands and fighting and, you know, working towards the same goal for the world's best candidate. And this is going to be a problem for the Republicans, because the Republican, you know, there's people not showing up for the Republican convention. Mm-hmm.
Although everything that I've read today, it looks like it's the minority, not the majority. That's even folks who said they weren't going to come, some of the delegates and the superdelegates, they're coming. A lot of my news is from California. I'll admit that, too, because that's what is on my radar. But some of the folks that had been dragging their feet, they're going. The stalwarts. In fact, they were featured in the paper, because I subscribe to the local county paper, too. And you know, one guy's been 8 times.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's a superdelegate.
This is my 11th. This is my 11th consecutive.
My goodness.
Convention. Yeah.
A lot of people can say that, Michael.
No, not a lot of people can say it. It's really where I started out in politics. And I won't digress too much, but I got to tell you that when I worked for a law firm right out of college, and I was volunteering for the Carter campaign, and I had the opportunity to go to the convention in 1980, and I took like 100 resumes with me. My sister laughed at me. I took 100 resumes with me, and I came back. I think I had one resume when I came back. I just, anybody that would stop long enough to say hello to me, I would give them a resume. And when I got back, I got a job at working for the Democratic National Committee. They needed somebody.
And, wow.
And it's funny. They told me when they hired me, they said, you know, this job is only for like 8 or 10 weeks. It's only until the campaign's over. But we need somebody right now. And I was there almost 4 years. So that really gave me my start in politics. And then I've been to every convention since. And I went to the last midterm convention, which was in 1982. So I went in 80, 82, 84, 88, 92, 96, 2000, 2004, 2008, 2012. And now I'm going in 2016, which will be number 11.
That is an amazing legacy. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. And you know what? It's been a great experience because I've gotten to do a lot of things, and I've gotten to meet a lot of interesting people. Rand was the person that allowed people on the podium temporarily in 1992 and, you know, met Rosa Parks and met all the luminaries that spoke. And it was just a great experience. And I'll tell you a great story about Governor Brown comes in 1992, mm-hmm. and they're not going to let him speak. So he sees that there's an opening where I am by the podium, and he comes by and stands in this doorway so all the press can see him, and the press kind of rushes the podium. Well, we've got Secret Service guys everywhere, but they close the door behind me.
Huh?
It's like they didn't say, "Come on inside." They close the door to protect everybody, and I was on the other side, and I'm like, "Well, thanks, guys." Really shows you who's important and who's not, you know. But anyway, yeah, it's been a great experience, and this will be great. And it's like a high school reunion for me to some extent because I see people I only see every 4 years.
Every 4 years.
Yeah.
Well, I understand AT&T, who's the official sponsor, has done amazing things to get everybody up and running with all the increased demands, which apparently is going to stay with Cleveland because of all the optic lines that they've dropped, and they've enhanced the satellites and the cell phone towers and all that sort of thing, because there's a whole bunch of media, of course, that's going to be broadcasting from there, let alone everybody else with their smartphone. Oh my gosh. I hope they don't have Pokemon Go around.
Oh my God.
That would just add more to the chaos.
We have people who are being robbed of their cell phones.
Yes.
Playing Pokemon.
Yes. Targeted. Yeah, because, well, they're otherwise distracted. But there is a GOP app if somebody wants to get involved that way, and it's available via the Apple Store or the Google Play Store. So you can see it from start to finish, because apparently they're broadcasting the every moment. And I guess they'll do that with the Democratic Convention as well. I don't know who's... their sponsor.
Yes.
I haven't read about that. Well, of course, that comes next.
Well, who do you think is their sponsor, Maria? AT&T.
Oh, also.
Yes, because he does play both sides of the aisle, right?
I guess
you never know who's. Yeah, and that's very common in Washington D.C. is to have law firms, for example, where one partner is on the finance committee of the RNC and the other one's on the finance committee of the DNC. So.
Wow. And then before Trump made his announcement, you and I had a sidebar conversation, and I believe that Governor Pence was who you thought that Trump would choose.
Yeah, I did think. I was pulling for Newt Gingrich just for the fun of it. But yes, I did think, because I think I think it was a wise choice on his part, because I think one of the problems that Trump has is that he's an outsider. He's an outsider. And Pence is not an outsider. He's an insider. Mm-hmm. And that may assuage some of the, you know, inside conservative people that won't come around to Trump. I mean, at least it's an attempt, I think, to satisfy those people that he's going to have a really honest-to-God conservative, because that's something you have to say about Pence. Now, I don't think he was a great choice in that he's not well-liked even in Indiana, but he does have the conservative credentials, and he's has experience, both of which Trump lacks. And, you know, his other options, he really didn't have a whole lot of other options available either. Christie, as far as I can see, you can't have Christie because Christie's as good at being Trump as Trump is. So, you know, you don't want a guy there who's going to be more, I don't know.
Flamboyant.
Flamboyant, perfect word. More flamboyant than the candidate himself is going to be.
The other thing about Christie is that they pull from the same demographics, the Northeast.
Right.
Yes. Whereas Pence brings the Midwest with him.
Right. They do pull from the same demographics. And I think that, you know, that the same people that are attracted to you know, the style that Christie has, kind of no nonsense, I'm in your face, I really don't care style, are also attracted to Trump. So I don't think he really would have gained anything with Christie, and he probably would have been somewhat overshadowed. And Gingrich just has too much baggage. He's got too much baggage.
I guess along your lines about the outsider, it would have been Dr. Ben Carson too. I thought that would have been a great choice. You got an intellectual, erudite man of color, but he's an outsider also.
Yeah, but you know what? I agree with you, and that would have been a gutsy call. I would have said that would have taken a lot of guts for what you just said, because he is an outsider. But it would have helped him, I think, immensely, not only to have this guy who's an intellectual and very well-spoken.
And thoughtful.
Thoughtful.
Credit, everyone's like, he doesn't have enough stage presence. I said, I don't care about that. I want to know what he thinks. And he's really good at articulating what he thinks.
Well, he's got, you know, as someone that goes out and speaks to the public a lot, I have for a long time, you know, tried to evaluate the speaking style of people and how, you know, I pay close attention to good speakers. And Obama has a really unusual style in that he's very, very thoughtful when he speaks. He doesn't talk down to people, and he's, in my estimation anyway, and he doesn't have that Baptist preacher thing. You know, a lot of really good black speakers have that, what I call the Baptist preacher thing, where they know how to get a crowd revved up and stuff. He does it in a different way. You know, he gets the crowd wound up a different way, and he speaks very softly and directly, and I think Carson's very good at that as well. I gotta say, I think that he's very good at that style as well.
Well, and he endorsed Trump early on after he dropped out of the race too, if you recall. Well, The View had him on, like, how dare you, how could you, and he was like, because it came from all sides when he did that, and I thought he held his own very, very well. I hope that he gets a nice position somewhere in the cabinet.
Well, I think, you know, I would think that even though I think you're being a little optimistic here.
I realized how I made that statement.
I think that if that happens, he would. And you know, I think he would have been a gutsy choice. But you know what? If I was an advisor to the campaign, I would say, this is what you need to do, man. This is what you need to do. You need to throw a Hail Mary pass at this point, because it's not looking good for you, Trump. It really isn't. And you know,
the numbers were closer this week than ever.
Well, that may be true, because people are scared of all this terrorism and stuff. But you know, who actually comes to the polls and pulls the lever? I think Trump's going to have a really hard time getting people to do that. I really do. I don't think it's over for him. I think that there are plenty more gaffes between now and November. There's a steep learning curve here. This isn't what people think it is sometimes. You got to know what you're doing to get this done.
Well, he's a quick study, but I agree with you. This and the severity and the momentousness of and the gravity of the position, all of those things. I mean, that, yeah, this is definitely going to be very interesting to see. Who knows if he becomes more, quote, presidential or more of the same. But in terms of your kumbaya stuff, the speakers that will be talking are everyone from Newt Gingrich to Paul Ryan to four Trumps, to Huckabee, Giuliani, Dr. Ben Carson, Ted Cruz. I mean, it's Scott Walker, Chris Christie. It's all over the map, which I thought was really interesting. And well, I guess that's probably the norm, right? You get them all?
Well, yeah. And I mean, certainly you're going to have the same thing at the Democratic convention. You're going to have the president and the vice president. You're going to have Chelsea Clinton. You're going to have all the mothers who've from the Black Lives Matter kind of movement, Michael Brown's mother and Trayvon Martin's mother and those people. You're going to have people across the spectrum. They certainly try to do that. But
you know whose name I didn't see was Sarah Palin's, and she came out in support of Trump early on, too.
Well, I think, you know, I think they see Sarah as a, you know, she may be seen as a detriment to him. You know, I think that there are people certainly in the media that can't stand her. And I don't know about people in the Republican Party, but I think that the core amount of people that like Donald Trump probably also like Sarah Palin. I don't think that they're too worried about.
I see.
You know,
so they don't need her to bring folks to the camp.
Yeah. I have this problem sometimes that I go out somewhere and they'll say, "Well, you know, the guys, he gives a pretty good speech and et cetera, et cetera. But you know, he could be a liability. Let's keep him on the down low, mm-hmm. You know, let's not put him out front because he's got an issue that is somewhat controversial in some places."
Michael, how long have you lived in the District of Columbia?
I've lived here on and off. I've lived here 35 years. So,
and
almost
that was a conscious decision.
Yes, because I grew up in Montgomery County, which is right outside the District of Columbia. And that's where my family moved when I was like 12-ish from New Jersey. And I went to high school there and I went to, you know, and then I moved into District of Columbia almost immediately because my older sister was a lawyer and my older sister didn't drive really. She hated driving and she got a job with a downtown law firm and she moved, you know, into a crappy neighborhood, but it was five blocks from the law firm. So that she could walk every day. And I moved in with her because I was an orphan. And I moved in with her for a little while when I was 18.
And what a then, sweet story that is.
Oh, yeah. She was a wonderful person. And then I moved back out when I decided to go to college when I was 21. I moved back out to Montgomery County because they wanted a ridiculous $35 a credit hour if I was a non-resident.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Didn't want to pay outrageous tuition like that. So I moved back to Maryland so I could pay $25 an hour. And then as soon as I graduated from college, pretty much, from graduate school, I moved back into the District of Columbia. And I've been here ever since.
Infamous ever
since. I used to live on Capitol Hill, which was my favorite neighborhood. But then I married a woman who had this crazy idea that she wanted to have children. Mm-hmm. So we moved to a little further out, which was more kid friendly. Mm-hmm. Capitol Hill was very expensive, and it was hard to get a place with a backyard. So we moved a little further out into a neighborhood called American University Park, where, you know, houses with yards and mm-hmm. kind of typical place. And we've lived
suburbia.
Here for 4 years. Yeah, it is. It's urban. It's urburbia. It's the urban example of suburbia.
Suburbia.
And we like it.
Good. So let's take a break and then segue to our guest, Dr. John Horton, and all things Zika.
Okay, we're going to do that, and we're going to, while we're, getting ready for our guests, we're going to play a song from Mariah Carey. This goes out to all the people of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Our hearts are with you. Okay, and we're back. And Maria, you want to introduce our guest?
I would be honored to do that. Dr. John Horton practices general and preventative medicine and has experience in travel medicine and teaching in Africa, Asia, and India. And he is the author of the book, The Inner Game of Stress, with co-author, renowned sports psychology expert, Timothy Galway. Dr. Horton, thank you so much for making yourself available and for taking the time to visit with us. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Thank you, Marie. It's always good to be on one of your shows.
As a reveal, Dr. Horton has been my medical correspondent over the years. So it's great to have you back in that capacity. And yes. How timely is it with the news that's been coming out about what's going down with Zika?
Yeah, Zika is puzzling to a lot of people. I mean, I think I can give a little bit of background if you'd like to.
Yes, please.
Please.
Okay, well, it's spread by the Aedes mosquito, which is a known character in travel medicine, certainly, because dengue fever, chikungunya, yellow fever, Japanese encephalitis, West Nile are all spread by this particular mosquito. So we know a lot about this mosquito. It bites aggressively during the day. It lives in stagnant water. It's more of a city mosquito, so that eradicating the mosquito in city areas, removing water areas, shallow water areas, stagnant water areas is very effective. So if one gets bit by it, this particular viral illness is really not a very serious infection. Now, the issue really is it causes birth abnormalities. Mm-hmm. So that's the fear of it. Many people will get this infection, they won't even know they have it. They can get the symptoms are fever, a little bit of a red rash, maybe a little bit of conjunctivitis, eye irritation, and some joint pains. Similar to West Nile. West Nile is not an uncommon virus, but very few people get very sick for it. Even less people get very sick from this virus. So the infection is not what's of concern. It's the fact that it can be passed from a pregnant mother to a fetus and then cause some severe brain abnormalities. And that might happen in perhaps 1% of women that are infected during pregnancy. Now, the infection during pregnancy can happen two ways. One is through a mosquito bite, and the other is through sex, because it is sexually transmitted. And I was just getting up to speed on the virus today, and I found that there's documented first transmission. Yep. Of the virus from a woman to a man, which hasn't been seen previously.
Right, because I read that news story yesterday, and then today I went on to the CDC to get some background information too, and they still had that it's only from male to female. So they hadn't even updated their site since the news is so new.
Yeah, no, it takes time. They're going to have to research it more. But, I mean, it makes sense. Most sexually transmitted diseases go from both sides, although it seems to have a longer life in the sperm than it would in the vaginal fluids.
Well, let me ask you something, Doctor. If pregnant women are really the group that needs to be careful about this, why are all the athletes going to the Olympics so upset about it? We assume that there are very few pregnant women amongst them.
Well, perhaps they're worried that if they go there and they become infected with the virus, then if they wanted to conceive, now the guidelines are, if you actually get the infection, and this can be found through blood tests or even urine tests, then men should wait like 6 months before conceiving. If they don't have any symptoms, if a man just goes to, let's say, an athlete goes to Brazil, they get some mosquito bites, they wonder, they get checked, they're not infected, they consider it to wait for 8 weeks because it has an incubation period of a few weeks. For women, it's 8 weeks either side. If a woman is infected and the body clears the virus, which it does, then she should wait for 8 weeks before getting pregnant, whether she's had an infection or not.
So that's what the men are saying, the male golfers especially, that they plan on having a family or they are going to have more children and they don't want to take that risk with their wives.
Yeah, I think that's the rationale.
So, but the question is if the symptoms come and go and they're somewhat benign, it's that you are carrying it in your blood system and in your seminal fluid?
No, this is what's interesting is that the body's immune system will clear this virus in a couple of 3 weeks. It doesn't linger in the blood. And probably if you've gotten an infection, you'll never get it again. We don't know that for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting because this virus is new in the Western Hemisphere. It's new in South America. Now it's in the Caribbean. It's been around for a long time in Africa. It was discovered in Uganda years ago. And it's considered endemic in Africa. So the difference between an endemic problem means that the virus exists there, but it's not infecting people. It's not spreading because it's been there for a long time. So people's immune systems have dealt with it, and it's not a problem. It's an epidemic here because people's immune systems aren't used to it, so they're getting infected and passing it from one to another.
But if they're putting up a six-month moratorium, does that suggest that it is available for 6 months to infect another?
In the sperm, not in
the sperm.
In the sperm. And we don't know how long it really lasts in the sperm. I think they're being very safe with that. But no one knows for sure.
Well, is there a way, Doctor, that we can immunize women against this, women that might become pregnant or that's not a possibility?
Well, I'm sure that it's being worked on. I don't know what stage it's at, but getting an immunization against a virus takes time. I mean, mm-hmm. they're in this viral category that we have this it's a flavovirus. Dengue fever is a much more fearsome disease than Zika, but doesn't cause the abnormalities in the fetus so much. But we don't have a vaccine against that. We do have a vaccine against yellow fever. We have a vaccine against Japanese encephalitis. Don't think we have a vaccine yet against West Nile. So that'll take time.
And time means money, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that their pharmaceutical company is going to invest in this.
Because there is no vaccine at this moment,
no,
Michael, to answer your question.
Right.
No, it hasn't been developed yet.
So my other question then, Dr. Horton, is if it leaves our systems roughly within 3 weeks, does that suggest that if you have a blood or a urine test thereafter that you will show negative?
Yeah, well, there's two ways. It's interesting because you can see if a person has had a virus, you get a certain immunoglobulin. It's called an IgG. That shows that you had that infection. It could be long, long ago, but it's not active.
Okay.
There's an IgM, which shows that it's active. So, I mean, to me, the most significant thing, as I've been studying this, is if a woman is pregnant because that's the scary thing, not getting the infection. Mm-hmm. But if she's pregnant, if you do an IgM antibody reading in the blood, if 2 to 12 weeks, let's say 12 weeks out from exposure, that's negative, this woman has no problem, is not going to have any problem with the virus being in her system. So we can tell this pretty easily.
So how does it get transferred and create the encephalitis situation?
Well, it's transferred through the amniotic fluid or through the blood. I'm not sure exactly how it gets from the mother to the fetus.
And how it gets there. In other words, because you said only 1% of pregnancies actually might result in that.
Well, it's we don't know. I mean, everyone's immune system is different. So once the virus is in the body is doing its best to get rid of it. So some women, you know, they might get pregnant very early when there's a lot of virus. Later on, there's going to be less and less virus. So that's going to be an individual issue.
Wow. So that's the randomness of this then.
Yeah.
And it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong here, doctor, but it seems to be spreading pretty quickly. I mean, yeah. Or is this just the media that's getting us all hyped up about it? Because this is something a few months ago was, you know, you saw an occasional thing on. Now you're reading it. And today in the Washington Post, they have an article about it. It's almost daily you're reading about it.
Right. It's epidemic in the part of the world that it's now started up in. What's interesting is at some point there's going to be enough resistance in the population that it won't spread so much.
Because we develop an immunity. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Once you have it?
Exactly. Once you have the immunity, you have it. So the way it works, I mean, if three of us are in Brazil, okay, and two of us have lived in that country for, you know, the last year or so, and maybe we've been bitten by the mosquito, we've had the virus in our system, it's not active, okay? So even though now we're getting bitten by the mosquitoes, we're okay, whereas the person that never was bitten and gets bitten, that person can get sick and that person could pass the virus on, but the other two, that's not going to happen. So over time, the sort of the so-called herd immunity, the immunity that's common in all of us, will cut down on the virus being transmitted, because it has to be transmitted from the virus in your body, then has to be transmitted to my body from a mosquito bite, so that the reservoir of the viruses are in us.
Do you think we're learning anything, doctor, about how we can coordinate among governments and since this is what we focus on the show, are we learning anything through this experience that will help us in the future? Because I assume this is not the last kind of virus like this we're going to see. That I think we all worry about what pandemics might be around the corner. Is there anything you see out there that are we cooperating to find ways to deal with this problem internationally?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question, and it's an excellent question, and I think the answer to it is yes. I mean, as I've been watching the SARS virus, for instance, that was like, you know, really happened very quickly. It was a virus that hadn't been seen. It morphed from animals to humans, and the worldwide coordination and cooperation from China to, you know, the United States to Africa, all over, was amazing. And guidelines came out quickly. People knew what to do quickly. Manufacturers got online to create vaccines. It wasn't needed so much because it wore out very quickly. So yeah, no, I think this is one area we may not cooperate that well economically or politically, but medically we do.
Great.
Well, that's heartening.
Yeah, because, a little bit interesting.
Well, there's been wrangling in Congress and the Senate over how much to allocate to the bill to even start working on it.
Well, you know, well, that's politics, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Well, I thought you were going to step in there.
No, it is. It's politics. They wrangle about everything.
$1 billion was in between either side of the aisle, as I recall. That I don't know that it got resolved. I haven't read anything about that.
No, I don't think it has yet.
I don't think that there's probably that much need, because in the United States, there's no evidence of homegrown transmission. There's about 1,300 cases of Zika. They're all from people that were traveling. I think 14 were sexually transmitted. Mm-hmm. And then the mosquito that does pass this along does exist in pretty tropical areas, so it's mostly in the southern United States. But the other viruses that we know about for a long time that have been endemic or epidemic around the world, particularly dengue and something called chikungunya, they've never really been transmitted very much in the United States. There's a few isolated cases of dengue from time to time in Florida. So a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of disease finds its roots in poverty. So yeah. If they're poor areas where there's a lot of stagnant water, a lot of mosquitoes are breeding, then you're going to have more mosquito-borne illness than in areas where you don't have so much mosquito breeding.
Yeah, I think people don't understand that sometimes, Doctor. I don't know if this is true, but I read somewhere that the single greatest scientific development in healthcare was the invention of soap. That more people, more lives have been saved since they invented soap. So sometimes, yeah, it's obvious that it's there are some very basic solutions. I wouldn't call them simple solutions. I remember the campaign funds, the campaigns that were raised to raise funds to buy mosquito netting in Africa, and how much they said that would help in preventing several diseases. So that's a very important thing.
Dr. Horton, can you give us a global perspective on how you practice travel medicine? Because as I recall, it depends on who's going where at what time of year as to how you immunize, et cetera.
Exactly. When people come in for a travel medicine consultation, we look at their exact itinerary, we look at their health, they look what they're going to be doing, and then we make recommendations. I mean, if you go on to the CDC website or World Health Organization and you tap in India, you're going to find a whole bunch of immunizations that could be given. But it's very different if you're going on a first-class tour in India or if you're backpacking through the jungles. That's a totally different itinerary.
So what you do and what you suggest isn't mandated, however. Is that correct?
Nothing is mandated. I mean, there's very few things in terms of public health that are mandated. There are countries that insist upon having yellow fever vaccine because they don't want the yellow fever to be transmitted from one country to another via mosquito. So they want to be sure that you've been immunized. That's the only thing that has mandated.
And the folks bring something that shows the dates of immunization and then the authorization to
right,
prove.
They get a yellow booklet and their immunizations are in there and then they're stamped so that then there's no problems in traveling from country to country.
And so some things that we may take for granted, like tetanus, is that something, like I can't remember when I got my last tetanus shot. Are we supposed to do that, like, what, every 10 years or something?
Yeah, exactly.
And again, that's just to us, up to us to remember that.
Yeah.
Michael, yeah. When was your last tetanus shot?
Oh, well, I don't know, but I stay away from, I try to avoid rusty nails. That's my preventative medicine routine. Maybe we should all wear dog tags, because I know when my dog had his last rabies shot, but I can't tell you when I had my last tetanus shot. Right?
And since Michael and I are in similar demographics, Dr. Horton, why didn't you speak to us about what your personal recommendation is about the vaccine that we're supposed to or we're eligible to get once we turn 60?
I think the most important are the pneumonia. We have two pneumonia vaccines now, which are very effective and can prevent a serious illness. Now we have the shingles vaccine, the herpes zoster. That seems to be very good, and that can prevent a nasty illness. you know, we're all supposed to get a flu vaccine every year to prevent that. What else is there? That's pretty much
those are the two. Now, because my sister was mentioning that she was going to get the pneumonia one, or I can't remember, one of those, and then she says there's something in it that she's allergic to, so she was told no.
Well, you know, the vaccines are made. There's certain things in them that one could have an allergic reaction to. But that's unusual. In our practice, we've rarely seen any sort of allergic action to an immunization.
And I can just tell you from personal experience that it's worth getting those vaccines. I get a flu because I'm diabetic, and I get a flu vaccine every year, and I've had shingles. And the strange thing about shingles, as you know, doctor, is that there's a very short period of time in which they can treat it. And if they don't treat it right away, it can get pretty severe. And I just got lucky that I thought it was just a rash, and I had a backache because I had just done some physical labor, and I happened to be at a doctor's appointment for something else, and he said, this looks like shingles, and it was. So they were able to treat it pretty effectively because I got diagnosed right away. So
boy, that was fortuitous.
That is the key. I mean, if you pick up on shingles quickly, and you know, you get antiviral medications, and then you know, we usually give, because we're an integrative shop, so to speak, we usually give things that will help the immune system to deal with it, antioxidants and some particular nutraceuticals that can help. And if you do that, and if you understand, a lot of times shingles arises when people are very stressed, because the immune system is interfered with when we're stressed. And if someone steps back and does something to get out of that stress, then the body can heal this rather well. In my own personal practice, I've never seen a severe shingles that didn't clear up easily if we did those things. If those things are not done, then yes, it can go on and be a chronic problem.
So for our listeners, by and large, do you recommend the shingles vaccine? Or is it, do you want to take that on as a case-by-case basis?
Well, you know, I try and not tell people what to do too much. But if they ask me, I'll say, yeah, if you're concerned about it, you ought to do it. If someone is not concerned about it, I'm not going to insist that they do so.
Yes. Well, I remember I knew two gals that had gotten horrible, 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 horrible cases of shingles, and I don't know why it went the way it did for them. I can't speculate on that. And so I thought, well, I'm just going to go get that. And CVS says, you know, shingle shot available here. And then when they asked my age and I didn't qualify, I was like, what's this about? I wasn't old enough.
Well, I wasn't that old when I got it. But I do live a really stressful life because I'm married and I have three children. So so I'm like a mouse in a boa constrictor cage. Always a lot of stress.
But you're also in politics, and I understand that's a little bit stressful.
Not compared to having three kids. Not compared to having three teenagers at the same time. It's a cakewalk. But hey, doctor, we're out of time. But thank you so much for coming on. I think this is such an important thing, and I hope you'll come back again.
And we did promote your website, too, so if anybody has questions, they can...
Please do it one more time.
We'll just tell you about the book, The Inner Game of Stress.
Okay, good.
That's a good book.
Okay.
It's a great book. But the website is hhdmed.com, and I think we put that out through all of our social media to promote your time here, Dr. Horton. So thank you again.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Of course.
Thank you. And thank you for listening, America. I'm going to be at the Democratic Convention this time next week, so we're not exactly sure how the show's going to go at this point, what we're going to do. But
we have to have your man on the street report live. Come on.
I will try to work that in, but it'll probably be on a scratchy cell phone because there's events planned from the moment we touch down on Sunday. So we will do some of that. And I'm going to see if I can get my digital recorder to work. So in case I get to the Republican convention, which I might do for a day, that we'll be able to get some man on the street interviews.
That would be awesome, Michael. Thank you, as always, for everything that you
right.
do.
No, thank you. And thanks for listening, America. We'll see you next week.
Have a great week. Thank you.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.